Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. We're at facebook.com/radiocafemc and on Twitter at radiocafemc. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Roberto Bedoya. He's executive director of the Tucson Pima Arts Council and is a writer and arts consultant who works in the area of support systems for artists. And David Groff, he is a poet. His latest book is called Theory of Devolution. And he's also editor of Persistent Voices, which is an anthology of poets lost to AIDS. And Denise Kumani Gant, who is an interdisciplinary theater artist and spoken word artist. And she's got a book of poetry called Conjuring the Dead. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So all of you are staying at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and we're going to talk a little later in the program about all the different things that are going on at the Art Institute. But right now, let's start with Roberto Bedoya. You are what Diane Karp, when she was telling me about you, said arts administrator, kind of policy wonk. And I think is that a bad thing to say?
No, that's not a bad thing at all.
But I think something that is very important to talk about and that rarely does get talked about, we talk about the arts and an artist and a piece that we might have seen in galleries and so on, but the infrastructure that makes all of this possible and that it kind of underlies the system that we have is something that is in a continual state of change and creation, and that's something that you look at pretty closely.
Yeah, I do. I mean, most of my writing is about sort of cultural practices and how they interface with policy. When I run the Local Arts Council in Tucson, you know, I'm a de facto policy maker. I determine, you know, how those public funds are allocated. And I'm very mindful of sort of questions of equity, questions of, you know, what does an artist need? How do I serve the majors, you know, the symphony or the ballet and their needs? And I like to joke that my charge is I have to support, you know, the white gloves to the anarchists. And so when you're there in that position of authority as a gatekeeper, and I put all that in quotes, you can't see my fingers up in the air right now, you have to be very mindful of, like, your responsibilities and ultimately how do you proceed ethically. So that's what I try to write about.
And what are some of the kind of problems that people fall into that when they're not mindful about it?
I wish I could swear, because it gets screwed up. You know, you get unhappy customers or unhappy people. You know, you're just, it's inequitable. I'm being a bit flip, but it's when you do it wrong, you know it. I mean, somebody will yell at you, whether it might be the mayor or it might be, you know, the best artist in town, or it might be the priest. You never know. So in some ways, you just have to be very mindful of, again, of, like, who are you supposed to serve? Ultimately, I privilege the individual artist, and they're the creative human beings that sort of feed our society, and so that's kind of where I privilege in my policy making.
So you are in charge of actually distributing funds to artists in Tucson?
That is correct.
And so when confronted with way more projects and perhaps even way more really worthy projects than you can fund, how do you make decisions?
Well, we use a peer review process. So, you know, obviously the community is involved in making the decisions. The message that you have to give to the public in many ways, both the artists or you know, art supporters, you know, with the downturn in the economy, you know, the days of your public arts agency being an ATM machine is gone. You know, you have to be very competitive. You have to make your case. You have to see a return on investment. That's not necessarily about, you know, the theater brings in X amount of monies to the local economy, but it's more about, like, how does this theater engage with its neighbors, with the diversity in this community? And that's kind of part of what you have to, the case-making you have to do when you're seeking public funds.
Probably around the time that I was born, there was I mean, the civil rights movement was happening, but it had not yet translated into arts policy and the kind of multicultural arts policy that we see now. How has the development of multiculturalism as a way of seeing the world and as a way of seeing the arts translated into arts funding and the kind of diverse communities that we would like to see? And I mean, how far are we even along in that process?
Well, it's constantly evolving. I think we're in a multiracial society. That's what the Obama election messaged. So language around multiculturalism is kind of shifting to what does it mean when you live in a multiracial society that includes not just, you know, people of color, but includes, you know, refugees, and includes, you know, white folk, it includes gays and lesbians. It includes a broad diversity of individuals with their own sort of cultural forms of cultural expressions. So how do you respond to that? So the questions currently in philanthropy, and not only do I work locally, I work nationally and on a number of advisory groups, is really the question of equity and how do you define it? What does that mean? How are you're serving your publics in the many ways that you're asked to do?
What does that look like on a national level? In other words, what's the nature of your participation in U.S. policy?
Well, my writings often are circulated nationally. Most recently, I've been writing about the notion of placemaking, which has been prompted by many, like about a national philanthropic organizations, not only the National Endowment for the Arts and their initiative called Artown, but, you know, another project called Art Place. And so so that's an interesting conversation, because I argue that before you, it really privileges the notion of the built environment that, you know, come to downtown and use the arts to revitalize a particular neighborhood. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but before you can have places of belonging, you have to have a sense of belonging. So you need to look at the politics of who has access and who doesn't have access, who has rights and who doesn't have rights. The history of placemaking in the U.S. is troubled, from Native American reservations to Japanese internment camps to redevelopment movements that resulted in strip malls. This is all placemaking, and how is this current conversation around creative placemaking complicit with that form of thinking, or really trying to, you know, foreground an ethos of belonging, which is the essence of what placemaking is?
Define placemaking.
It's where you belong. It's like, do you know the history of your block? I mean, do you know the history of your neighbor? Do you know the history of, like, I was driving down the street and I was talking to Diane. What's that big empty lot there on Cerritos, where the school used to be? And then all of a sudden I hear the story of that development. That's placemaking, whether you build something or you take something down. And you need to ultimately feel, if you are a human being and you feel you have civil rights, you need to feel that you belong to the place you're living in. That's just kind of a simple.
Which is so interesting, because we're also in a moment where, first of all, a lot of us are continually traveling. Like, the three of you sitting at this table are all coming from elsewhere and finding a community of artists that is not in the place that you're living in now. And there's so much communication on the internet, and so many real alliances and communications are made that way that are outside of geographical place.
But, you know, place can also be a community of values. It can be a community of interests. I mean, I lived in Los Angeles for the longest time, and there was a great social geographer by the name of Ed Soja. And he talks about being translocal in the LA context, which means that, you know, I worked in Santa Monica. I knew the grocer there. I knew my dry cleaner was there. But I lived across town in Silver Lake, and I knew people there. So you're always, in a sense, we're always translocal. We all have a sense of locale. And yet we can move, you know, through a city and carry that sense of, well, I know that place, and I know that place, and I know that place.
You were talking about multicultural, multiracial society in which we live, and the translation of that phenomenon into the arts. I mean, one of the things that I think has been probably and still is an adjustment is that certain kind of art forms, which are European in origin, have been privileged over other kinds of art forms that are not European in origin. What does that look like from your perspective?
I just want a good art experience. I can get it at the opera. I can get it at a poetry reading. I can get it in a visual gallery. I can see it on the street. And so in some ways, I don't want to. So maybe that's not really answering your question. It's being a little slippery about that. But what I really think is really, especially when you're dealing with the majors, is notions of engagement. How are you engaging your public? Are you creating sort of a situation of passive engagement where I'm sitting in the theater and I'm listening to a play, watching a play? Or are you doing active engagement, which means that maybe that play was written by your youth group that you've really supported? So that kind of aesthetic experience ranges. And, you know, you just need to be open to it all.
But, I mean, in historically, there's been more money for the ballet and the opera than there has for, you know, the Yoruba Cultural Center, say.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, the wealthy like the opera and the symphony, and they give. And I can't damn that. I mean, I have to, as a public funder, I, like I said very early, my charge is to show the whole breadth of a community, and I don't have a whole lot of money. So I have to be really strategic how those monies are allocated. And, you know, ultimately, you know, there's some sort of, ultimately, you know, I guess what I do sort of privilege in my grant making in the agency I run is this notion of engagement. How do we use the arts to engage the public? And it could be around this, you know, a notion of beauty. It can be about, you know, the political, you know, disenfranchisement of Latinos in Arizona. I mean, it can range in that whole world of activities.
We're talking to Roberto Bedoya, and let's turn now to Denise Kumani Gant. You have been sitting here kind of nodding and saying, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have been nodding to Roberto because in my past life, I was the executive director of two different arts organizations. And so I really understand lots of the issues. And one of those organizations, the Village of Arts and Humanities, was a community arts organization grounded in a community.
Where was that?
In Philadelphia. And the Village, a really unique organization where we did land maintenance, so we took vacant lots and turned them into parks and gardens. We had a youth program, but we were also engaged in really community redevelopment with residents, and had some successes and also had some failures. It was tough and interesting work. So just hearing Roberto just reminded me of that work that I used to do.
Let's talk about that for a moment. When you did projects that really had an arts component but also a redevelopment component, what did that look like? What were some of the successful ones?
We did this exhibition in Philadelphia called Evoking Spirit, Embracing Memory. And we were really lucky at the time. We received funding, huge funding for us, which was about $200,000. Over 2 years from the Pew Exhibition Initiative to do an exhibition. And for me, one of the great things about that project was that we took our time. And we took our time to really listen to community residents. We did a number of conversations with members of the community. And we learned out of those conversations that a lot of stakeholders in the community had passed away. And we decided to build that exhibition around people who had died, who were important to the community. And that part of North Philadelphia, you had people like Tammy Terrell, who were from that part of the community, and then you had someone like James Big Man Maxton, who was the tenured artist at the Village. And these people had passed away. And so we created an exhibition over those 2 years. But I think, again, the important thing was to listen to what residents wanted and to have our curators respond to that as opposed to imposing their point of view in terms of creating a community project.
It's very interesting. It's a theme that I keep noticing over and over, which is doing things from the top down versus doing them from the bottom up. And listening and doing things from the bottom up seems to yield very different and often much more profound and appropriate results.
Yeah, I don't even see it as top down, bottom down. I really think of it much more as a circle, and that it's incredibly important to kind of embrace what circles represent in terms of creating projects, that everyone, when you're sitting in a circle, there's an equality to the voices. So yeah, there's a certain expertise that I might bring as an arts administrator to the table, and I might not know how to get particular funding, but then a community resident will really know what the community needs. Usually, if I'm not living in that community, they know more than I do. Absolutely.
So you were an arts administrator for a long time, and then you just decided to throw it in?
Well, you know, I had these simultaneous tracks in my life for 20 years, where I was running arts education programs and working as an arts administrator, and then I was making my own work primarily as a theater artist. And I came to the conclusion that my artwork was not going to advance to the next level if I continued to be an arts administrator. And so I decided a year ago to at least for, you know, give myself a year and a half to make writing the primary focus. I've been looking for jobs that are not executive director based, and I haven't been successful in finding one. But I have had the great opportunity to attend a number of residencies, and they've really given me the time to expand my work. And that's been my focus.
So tell us a little bit more about what you're working on.
Well, you know, I'm interested in sort of three large topics, and I am the kind of artist that I find it difficult to focus, and so I'm usually working on at least two or three things at the same time. The area that I think is my primary interest right now is looking through poetry, through playwriting, looking at the African diaspora and slavery and how that continues to be part of the consciousness of the United States. It is something that I still feel the country hasn't come to grips with. And interestingly enough, when I was working at Center Stage in Baltimore, I was the director of the education programs, and we did a project where we brought together African-American students and Jewish students because we were looking at Peter Weiss's play, The Investigation, which was built out of the testimony from the first civil trial dealing with Holocaust. And it was really interesting for me how the African-American students did not celebrate the fact that their ancestors had survived what no one should really survive. Whereas dealing with the Holocaust, there was a great deal of students knew about it, and celebrated, of course, is not the right word, but they honored that part of the history. So that took me on a trek. I've also been I'm sort of a devotee of Randall Robinson, who was the founder of TransAfrica, and his book, The Debt, What America Owes Black People, is one of those books that changed my life. So that's one huge area of interest. That's what my play is focusing on. I'm also interested in being a woman and what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a woman of a certain age, or, you know, no longer a girl. And so I'm currently also writing a collection of poems called Hag that looks at the mythology of hags, because, you know, hags and incubi and succubi, and then also take some of the women of the Bible, like Eve, like Hagar, and turns their stories somewhat on their heel.
Very, very interesting. I think it's been my conviction for a long time that the United States has basically been fighting some version of the Civil War for, what, three centuries, something like that. We just cannot, and I don't know what it is about us as a country that we cannot get past slavery.
Well, it's slavery, it's also, I mean, and you know, I say slavery because you know, at least the majority of my ancestors are African, of African descent. But I do think the country in general has a history of not being able to deal with atrocities that have happened on our soil.
Right.
So what's happened to Native indigenous people here in this country, something that the country collectively hasn't been able to deal with. What has happened with the Latino population, something we really can't talk about. What has happened, the fact that we actually interned people, the Japanese, here. So I think that's been part of the American character, that we gloss over those things that are negative in our past. And I really feel, you know, Malcolm X said, you know, the chickens have come home to roost. And I feel like we're just reaching this very critical part of our history where if we don't deal with the past, then those demons are going to catch up to us. And of course, I try to do this. I mean, my ultimate goal is healing. It's not necessarily about trying to point a finger and saying, oh, you did this to my people, blah, 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 blah. But I feel slavery is an American story, and it's one that we've got to come to grips with, because we have slavery still existing in our country.
Very much so. We're talking to Denise Kumani Gant. Now let's turn to David Groff. You are a poet. It's so interesting to have the three of you here together, because you are a poet who has worked with yet another community, namely people who have been lost to AIDS, and poets in particular.
Yeah, I feel that, well, a lot of us, whether we realize it or not, lead lives that are affected by, that are parts of history and affected by our times. And we may not always acknowledge that, but certainly it's the case for so many of us. You know, I was born in the midst of the civil rights world and grew up ultimately as the only white child in an all-black school outside Newark, New Jersey, and had that sense of outsiderness and at least some view of a different perspective and a different tumult in the world. And then I came of age and came out just as AIDS was descending, and through luck and some awareness, I was able to survive that, and ultimately felt that I had to be kind of a witness and a testifier to what I saw that others didn't survive. So many of my poems and much of the work I've done as a literary citizen has dealt with curating the memory and fostering that and dealing with the fact that AIDS and HIV, even as it's a very immediate fact and still in the Western world and in the rest of the world as well, is also, contrary to what Susan Sontag said, an amazing metaphor for all the issues that we face as human beings around mortality and love and justice. AIDS remains an incredible issue of justice and access here in America and certainly around the world.
I have often wondered, morbid as this may sound, if I knew that I had a very limited time to live, what I would do, what I would express, how I would live. And here you have a lot of people in community with each other who had to face that. How did that, what did you see? What kind of decisions did you see people make, and how did it affect their writing, their poetry?
Well, there was certain people, I think for everyone, there was a sense that we had to live very much in the moment, that there was a kind of urgency that, you know, this sundown could be your last sundown. And that certainly informed a lot of writing, both fiction, poetry, and playwriting around AIDS and HIV. Certain writers, as I've discovered when I was one of the editors for this anthology, Persistent Voices, Poetry by Writers Lost to AIDS, just did their own thing and kept on in, you know, plowing the fields they'd plowed. Well, for others, for example, Paul Manette, the novelist, memoirist, and poet, was able to access entirely new forms and new subjects and performed ultimately, I think, was able to write from a place of anger and of activism, which I think is still pretty rare in lots of American letters. And I think opened up us to what I like to call radical content, the ability of the arts not to find only new forms, but to actually find new things to include in the arts that often can challenge us, whether that's sexuality or science or politics.
When we look at how far the gay civil rights movement has come just in the last, decade or so, it's pretty interesting and amazing, and I guess a testament to the power of activism. Mm-hmm, what do you see, and how do you see that reflected in the arts?
Well, first of all, I did something that astonished me this past summer, which was to marry legally in New York State my partner of 16 years. We were married 16 years to the day we met, and I still find this incredibly unreal.
What it astonished you that you did it?
Well, it astonishes me that any of us have done it, and it's an amazing phenomenon that I'm frankly not used to yet. I don't yet own the word husband, even though I'm, you know, committed to Clay and wear a wedding ring, which is also this odd piece of a badge and a piece of baggage that is still kind of something to get used to. But clearly there was a lot of activism, and I think in this case, coming less from the leaders of the gay movement in many cases than from the people who just saw issues of justice and injustice in their own lives as they had tried to adopt children, for example, or as they tried to survive partners who died of AIDS or simply, you know, in old-fashioned ways of dying. And all of those things, I think, kind of created a great groundswell that political gay activists had to kind of catch up with, until it became a movement that is important for people who are coupled, but also represents great issues of access and justice for people who choose not to be or not yet in some kind of relationship.
And of course, I mean, a lot of it does go back to the 1980s, when there was the necessity for a huge movement to even get medicine and get research.
Absolutely. I mean, I was one of the foot soldiers in ACT UP, you know, the one who never... I thought a lot of my work as an editor and publisher and writer would do some of my activism, and I think that was the case, and I regret never having been dragged off in handcuffs. But having just seen the movie How to Survive a Plague, which will certainly be coming here if it hasn't already, and another movie by Sarah Schulman from a more activist view called United in Anger, there was an incredible movement to really create, to center things around patients for the first time, and to create real groundswells around issues of justice, but also issues of access to medicine, that have transformed healthcare, I think, and certain ideas of activism that you see in the Occupy movement for all peoples, and not just certainly people with AIDS and HIV.
So let's talk about the anthology Persistent Voices, and there's another anthology that you have coming out as well.
Right. It's another gay-themed anthology called Who's Your Daddy? Gay Writers Celebrate Their Mentors and Forerunners.
Oh, okay.
We've gotten a lot of fun pushback on that title, which I stand by completely. The AIDS poetry anthology was called Persistent Voices, and I worked with a young editor who grew up as a teenager essentially reading the gay and non-gay poets who were confronting HIV in their own bodies and lives. And we worked together to create an anthology that is everyone from James Merrill and David Matias to Paul Manette, Essex Hemphill, a number of writers kind of on the range, whose writing often had been eclipsed since the years of their death, and now is kind of persisting in a way that I'm really, really happy about. And while all of my work is not around AIDS and HIV or gay issues, so much of it is, including my poetry book and my own writing as well.
Do you feel like there's a link between the gay community and the whatever the rest of the population? In other words, do you have non-gay people reading these books?
I think we do, but I think there is a great challenge that remains for gay and lesbian writers and all kinds of LGBT writers, which is that our work, except perhaps around AIDS, is not seen as representing universal issues. Years ago, when I was an editor, I published a novel by Paul Manette about AIDS widowers, in fact, and we got a rave review in the New York Times magazine book review by Judith Viorst, I believe it was, who wrote that this novel transcends gay lit to invite us all in. And that entire mentality that this particular minority, like other minorities, and perhaps even more so in a more retarded way, does not represent the issues or true inquiries into love, death, connection, I think is still one of the kind of fundamental prejudices in our country today, and one that we see certainly in the publishing industry, where LGBT writers remain, at least in prose, quite marginalized, perhaps more so than ever.
I'd love to see a review saying this book transcends New England lit to include us all.
Well, we ultimately saw a lot of that with the Southern writers, for example, with African American writers, where there has been that sense that they are not just a regional or provincial or operating on the issue of in the realm of society and culture, but through something deeper. And I think we see that with certain queer writing, particularly around AIDS, and perhaps more and more around marriage, the kind of Brokeback Mountain mentality. But I think we still have a long way to go in that, except in poetry, where there's the issues and the stakes are so small that you can kind of do whatever the hell you want. And there's a lot of great, I think, radical content being written in all kinds, politically and sexually and socially, by gay and lesbian and trans writers.
We're talking to David Groff, Roberto Bedoya, and Denise Kumani-Gant. Now, all three of you have brought work to read, and I thought maybe this would be a good opportunity to hear some of your... I think everybody brought poems, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yes,
it is.
Yes.
Would you, Roberto, like to read something?
Sure. This poem is called Doing Pulses. It is written for a colleague of mine, Greg Bordowitz, who's a gay activist and queer AIDS activist, and Jean Randolph, who is a scholar in Canada. So it's got, let's see, hopefully got 4 or 5 sections. There's no rhyme to reason to this, each section, but here it goes. Doing Pulses. 1. There it lies, responsibility. With an ethic, often with an aesthetic, because of the value thing, a chain. That and there are doing pulses instead of push-ups. A container for metaphors, art, politics, damn love. Wicked shifts that tease, torture, capacity in the out to another eye. 2. A simple volley over the table that sank into my steps. Dang, I'm it. Run as I do in a continuous conversation with root and between that figures in the sway of hips. One ponders and asks with bubblegum and Coltrane of the form and order of an ethics of abundance and aesthetics of beholding. Whole resonance in response. How do you proceed to promise in light, life worth living in the clothing of as if intellectual could properly speak of exchange relationships, us and within, judgment and value, aesthetics and ethics, the good and the goods, the fine piano playing of the generative, happily, the world, oceans, sense, critique, and art, flexing logics that clock on a day, the parts that move potentiality to ends and beginnings, one ponders and asks. 3. Miss Sueño's sash and crown, rocking horse, call of form and function, legislations and propositions, unhinged by the circumstances, the conditions of insight, not a fall month or a movement of, but by sunrise and pupils in other, in the parade of will, worth, and racials. 4. Abundance and glitter drive, laced with swoons and consequences, speaks low as if it were a breath in need and asks you to dance. Ethics turns slowly on its legacy of debate and relationships. Those walk-on-bys nestle into you and dutifully deliver small bites on the neck of thought. 5. All the while listening to Dion Singh Burt, watching the turns in incitement, a desire not for objects but for flourishing, the share in lyrics, ethos, relations to pronouns and percussions, as the wave in the ocean called ethics tells excessive stories of pleasures and wobbles on the edge of logic's affects, madness and comfort. Wave ahead, the wee that runs along the shore touching distance, and those wees you don't know, be it the numerous, the many, the lavish not I that reaches without papers or traces, with impulses to seeing the length and depth daily manners tethered to ethics and aesthetics. Inside these fervors, doing as attention to concern and composition.
Roberto Bedoya, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's go on. Let's just have everybody read one poem. Do you want to go now, Denise?
Sure, I'll go. Just one little caveat. This is an old piece. I wrote it in 2001, and I wrote it literally the night that I heard Randall Robinson speak, so he's one of the people I dedicate this work to. A coil called skin. I know in the back of my DNA, in that coil called skin, There is a memory before chains, but I cannot conjure it. A story of people naked and satisfied, their knees anchored in prayer. By the edge of the Sahara, in the Serengeti, on the kiss of my lover's tongue, there's another tale, a song wrought from steel and revolution. So in these four chambers, in these four corners, in the four walls of my heart, I spread phoenix wings toward sky, wrap my wounds in musky soil, gather tears for you to drown in, ready myself for the release of this final reckoning. As if their melody clings tightly to my womb, I compose praise songs to Auser and Auset, Mawu and Lisa, Oludumari, anoint my head with seven power stand by Elegbara at a cross in the middle of my road. But I still can't find heaven here. Only yesterday, before this scheme was so carefully constructed, there was a story I could selfishly call my own, its words buttressed against the seasons. It held a legend larger than my life, a headstone domed in dahlias to provide solace from the pain. Once these lips held other languages, my hips were dignified by their size, I knew how to dance with haints and spirits, anchor these thick, dark thighs into the ground, and grow roots here. But this is not the good soil. My handprint everywhere, but my signature invisible. And I cannot remember, and I cannot forget. I cannot remember, I cannot forget. Too often when I'm sleeping, I dream a nightmare flowing from earth. Thumbs ripped from sockets. Neck locks, lips pinned to dresses. Backs broken, heads in rope, dogs running, hands bleeding. And we wonder why black folk are crazy. What happened deep in this soil? What happened here in America that made me forget the story of my name? You see, I do not know if I am the Ga, the Asante, the Igbo, the Yoruba, the Zulu, the Mandinka, the Beniluluwa, Chakwe, Hutu, Dagon, Dijeni, Banyankole, Idu, Mbuti, Lamatwa, Zwaza, Wolof, Fulani, Fan. I do not know the names of my people, where they come from, stripped of everything, stripped down to the marrow, stripped down to the white crack of bone. I cry and I cry and I cry and I cry, but my tears are neither wide enough or thick enough or pure enough to heal this wound, to redeem this transgression without you. So I ask that you hold my lack of memory, sit with the terror of this morning, listen without an ounce of denial. Abide in me and feel the blood staining your toes. Blood of the Seminole, the Lakota, the Cree. Blood of black folk, no tribe. Blood of Chinese railroad men, Zapatistas, Nagasaki, Japanese internment camps. Blood of body burning on cross, body hanging in tree, babies bombed in temple. Blood of no country, no name. Blood of ignorance. Each of us swaying to the blue square, white stars, red. Walk with me and let our souls change color. Maybe then I'll stare into your dark brooding eyes, our only redemption, the embrace of hesitant, abundant arms, loving as deeply as we are able.
Denise Kumani Gant, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's turn to David Groff.
Thank you. This poem is from my forthcoming book, Clay, and Clay is the name of my husband. He has a very poetically fortunate name, and he grew up not that far from here in Farwell, Texas, which is just over the border from New Mexico, and where you kind of go to Clovis, New Mexico, to do anything at all. And we would often go back to visit Farwell and end up, you know, in New Mexico. And I was always fascinated with the change in time, which as an East Coast kid was really wild to me, that you would lose an hour, essentially, when you drove, you know, when you walked, really, to the edge of town. And this poem is about that. It's called Jacked. And the epigraph is Farwell, Texas, toward Texaco, New Mexico. Driving late to the chain motel, past the empty lot of a town, inhaling the feedlocked reek, plateaus of pulverized dung. After seeing Clay's father fresh from his lung scan, and his stepmother thinned thanks to a third tumor, we heard on the rental tires an uproar of thud and crunch akin to swallowing meat as heard from within your head. Then something flicker or fly, a sack or shooting star that fled like a jackrabbit. Jackrabbit, Clay remarked, steering at 10 and 2, steady on the gas. My heart leaped into my head. Shouldn't we stop? Should we see what we hit? I, a city boy, always felt exempt from corpses on the road. But Clay, a frontier stock, who let his father kill his pet Raquel and her piglets and ate pork within the year, who saw his mother die of one of the cancers the town harvests like winter wheat, who was the last of the gay boys who slipped out and then returned, the oldest to die of AIDS, another to rev the car to death in a closed garage, Clay, who treats his blight of HIV with ruthless pesticides, cruised into the night. Jackrabbits die under tires. The pioneer blood demands, and mile after mile requires speed and brutal thrust. At midnight in the high plains dark, as we plunged past the tracks that separate the states and mark a zone of time, we gained an hour of life.
Poet David Groff, it's just such a privilege to hear all three of you read, and I was wondering if each of you maybe could talk about the dynamic between the creative process and actually writing your work and then getting it out there and actually being heard, which is such a, it seems like it, it's such an important part of the completion of the work.
Well, you know, I kind of think of myself as a bard, which is I also sing. And for me, writing the work is a piece of it, but it's often, and I'm even learning this even now as I'm doing more readings, that for I think for my work, there's something about putting the human voice to it. It's also why I work in theater, that I'm really interested in actually words on sound and you know, this idea of, you know, I think of it, it's sort of akin to the Black Church, you know, this idea of bearing witness that people need to listen, and we all need to listen and to be heard, you know, that there's a dynamic. In terms of getting the work out there, yeah, for me, I am a 50-year-old emerging artist, and, you know, it continues to be a challenge to figure out how to get my work out there, and to have it produced. But, you know, I, being older, I think one of the things that's also happened to me is that I'm beginning to value every experience that I can when I have the opportunity to share the work. So that if, you know, particularly this poem that I read, it just seems to kind of get people or touch people in a particular way. So if one person's moved by it, one person's moved by it. And I'm less and less interested in a multitude of people knowing about my work as opposed to, you know, the right person being touched or moved by it.
Right, right. Roberto, what about you?
Well, you know, I started off in my career in the arts as a writer and a playwright. And then, you know, found myself all of a sudden moving into this area of arts management and now policy making. So I don't have a real rigorous writing habit. I just like write poems for friends when I feel moved. And so the audience is them, and occasionally somebody says, hey, do you have anything new you want to submit to this magazine? And I say, okay. But if I didn't have that little practice, I don't think I could do my work. I mean, I think in the poem I read, I think an awful lot about the relationships between ethics and aesthetics. I think an awful lot about what when David was talking about witnessing and what does it mean to be engaged in critical witnessing as a writer or as a art maker to the world we live in. So, you know, my writing practice just, I hate to say this, but it's a narcissistic activity that I really love. It makes me happy.
David?
Well, I guess I start from the idea that art and poetry in particular is not at all about self-expression. I hate the idea of self-expression. That's what diaries are for and things you keep private. Art is an extremely high and urgent form of communication. And this is one of the first things I try to tell my students, that you know, you really are trying to connect in an intimate way, one-on-one or in groups with people. And that's really what matters, because you're not only getting something off your chest and clarifying it, you have, I think, ultimately a responsibility to get it out into the world. I teach a course to my MFA students that kind of terrifies them. It's on literary citizenship, and starts with the whole idea that you have a responsibility to your writing, to the quality of your writing and your experience, and to the culture, to get your work out there, to respond and read other people's work, to go to readings, to really kind of participate, not just as kind of a somebody, you know, shooting a little missile off and hoping it will hit somebody or getting it off your chest, but kind of bringing yourself into a larger community. And I think the world, better for better or worse, demands that of the artist these days. And one artist friend of mine quoted another artist friend saying that the most radical act for artists today is finding an audience. And certainly for poetry, where, you know, print runs are under 1,000 copies, that's a real issue. But I think there is a real responsibility to do that. And it, not everybody is made for that. I mean, Emily Dickinson, whose birthday was yesterday, she was 182, I think, would run screaming from this very idea. And I respect that. But I think if you have it in you, you really are required to be a worker in the cultural vineyard as much as you can do with your own work and with reading and listening and propounding the work of others as well.
I mean, I think really, in a way, the artist's work, the literary producer's work, is to help us get to know ourselves and each other.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think there's a real sense of community here. I mean, I love poetry readings, as glib as they can be, you know, or because they're incredibly meditative times, I think, and they really do bring people together. The arts, even the written ones, I think, are still community acts, however they're disseminated.
Well, speaking of poetry readings, there's all kinds of events coming up, and I wanted to announce some of those events. This Saturday, the 15th of December, there is an open call exhibition pushpin show at the Lucky Bean, and that is in Sambusco Center in downtown Santa Fe. And the community artist one-day market, pop-up market of artist-made objects, and all the proceeds are going to the artists, and that's part of a whole set of things that the Santa Fe Art Institute is participating in. And then there's a reading on Monday, December 17th, also at the Lucky Bean. And there will be readings. I guess all three of you are reading at this. Is that correct? Roberto, you're not here anymore. But okay, but Denise and David will be reading at mm-hmm. that. And then there's also an open mic component, so people are welcome to bring their work and participate at the end. And then on Wednesday, December 19th, there's an opening reception for the studio workshop for young people. 7th and 8th graders at DeVargas Middle School have been working on a project called Cityscapes. That's at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And then finally, on Thursday, December 20th, there's an open studio at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. So a lot of things going on at SFAI, which can be found on the web at sfai.org. Denise Kumani-Gant, interdisciplinary theater artist and spoken word artist. David Groff, poet and editor. Roberto Bedoya, poet and executive director of the Tucson Pima Arts Council. I want to thank you all so much for being with us and having this conversation here in the cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you so
this
much.
Great.